This episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast is presented by Sling TV. Coming up this week, you've got the Premier League as well as the CONCACAF Champions League and Ligue 1, much, much more also, all available through Sling TV. Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris and I'm joined by my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. We're back and we are doing two episodes a week. This is the early week edition. Kartik, lots going on. Of course, there's Wednesday, biggest match of the season, Arsenal against Manchester City on Peacock. This one could have huge ramifications on the title, depending on which way it goes. Rather than concentrate on that, which I'm sure everyone's going to, I'm looking forward to it, definitely. We had a press release on, I think it was on Monday, kind of a late press release from CBS Sports. Now, this might be by complete coincidence, or this might be something that, that they heard our input from the podcast, I think a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about lower league soccer, and we're like, okay, yeah, Footy Morning is great. Great coverage by CBS Sports, Golasso Network, about European soccer, even MLS, etc. But our criticism was really no discussion of lower league soccer, probably no discussion at all during that first week. Well, things have changed pretty quickly. So whether they're listening to us or just kind of within themselves kind of thinking about this, they made an announcement on Monday about three games from the US Open Cup. They're going to be shown live streaming on the Golasso Network. And these are US Open Cup games involving MLS teams versus lower league soccer teams. So this is really fantastic news, available for free. What's your perspective on this, Kartik? I mean, you have for a long time been very involved in lower league soccer, throughout your entire life and career. What's your analysis about this deal that CBS Sports made, albeit at the last minute?
So actually, I going back to the first thing you said about Arsenal versus Manchester City, I'm so in a different world than people who just watch the Premier League that somebody yesterday, a colleague of mine, said at the end of our conversation, which was about a political matter, are you going to watch the game on Wednesday? And what about the game on Wednesday? Blah, blah, blah. And I assumed he was talking about the Miami FC Inter Miami match, because he's in South Florida, and spoke for like a minute. Yeah, the CBS deal, and it's great. And then he's like, no, I'm talking about Arsenal Man City. And I was like, oh, that game's Wednesday? I didn't even realize it. So I'm in a different world than most other people. But yes, this is a big, big deal. It's something that I don't want to reveal too much because I had some inside knowledge of what was going on, but it was something that was worked on by the clubs involved, right? And there are three matches that are being shown, including Tormenta tonight. We're recording this on Tuesday. Tormenta against Charlotte FC. Tormenta, which is from Statesboro, Georgia, is one of the model clubs in lower division soccer in terms of the way they're structured. At the youth level, they have a women's team. They have a professional men's team that's playing in this match. Miami FC and Inter Miami, which I teased earlier, and that match will also be available on the CBSMiami.com website nationally. There's no geo block on it, so you can watch that broadcast via the Golasso channel, which is obviously free and national, or CBS Miami. And then Portland and Orange County SC. Orange County SC is a USL club in Orange County, California. They won the title 2 years ago, and they have a very good relationship with the local Los Angeles CBS station. So big, big deal, and it's something that allows the US Open Cup to kind of emerge from the shadow. Right. The only previous time I remember a late announcement like this is when Eric Winalda's Cal FC, remember that, was taking on Portland in Portland, and Fox had a vested interest at the time. Winalda was a Fox personality, and also Nick Webster, our former host of this podcast, or forerunner of this podcast, was on the coaching staff of Cal FC. And they picked up that game late, and it was really like this really exciting development. There was so much excitement yesterday, Chris, when this announcement came out. I mean, there were people DMing me and texting me, this is the greatest thing ever. Daniel Feuerstein, who of course writes for World Soccer Talk and has his own show, in haste wrote this celebratory article that I posted on Beyond the 90. It feels like this is a big, big moment. But is it a one-off? That's the big question. But right now, it's huge for the U.S. Open Cup. It's huge for the three USL teams involved who are all playing MLS teams and will be now on national television.
So what do you think the reaction was when this idea was floated? And then Turner Sports, who have the rights to U.S. Soccer and Turner Sports, have the rights to the U.S. Open Cup, are showing some of the games on Bleacher Report and or YouTube. And U.S. Soccer has gotten a lot of criticism for not making every single game available. What do you think the reaction was within Turner Sports and within U.S. Soccer when CBS made a call and said, hey, what do you think about us showing some of these games that otherwise for some people would not be available?
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of unhappiness this year, and I let me make this clear. There's been a lot of unhappiness this year with Turner Sports among fans. It is not Turner's fault. It's actually the U.S. Soccer Federation that's cut back on their production costs and their willingness to pay for production for every match and then put it on television or streaming. So in the last tournament, every match was produced by U.S. Soccer and put on ESPN+. This year, U.S. Soccer is only producing 8 matches per round in the early rounds, which means those 8 matches do end up on Turner or Bleacher Report, which is Turner's digital presence. So what has happened is the other games have been left to a, quote, team cast. So the teams can either show the game and pay for production and deal with that on their own end, or the matches aren't streamed. So last round, for example, we had a match in Florida, Tampa Bay Rowdies versus Nona FC, two teams from the state of Florida, that was not streamed. And in order to do my match report, I was actually texting with people at the game. That's how bad it was. That was like that's like circa 2005, right? So CBS had three teams in this case that were willing to pay for production and work on their own. The Charlotte Miami FC, who as I've mentioned is affiliated with the local CBS station in Miami Fort Lauderdale anyway, and Portland, and I think this is kind of a bailout for U.S. soccer. I think that this is something where people have been very angry and they've been blaming Turner. And I think it's because Turner comes with very low credibility with some fans because of what happened with Champions League a couple of years ago. But in reality, this is a U.S. soccer error, and this is now a bailout. They've got three more games not only being broadcast, but now being broadcast on national television, which makes the Open Cup, which kind of does the marketing job that U.S. soccer is not doing effectively, much more effective thanks to CBS.
Now, the reality, Kartik, to bring you down to earth, right, for Wednesday, for example, arguably out of everyone that's watching soccer on Wednesday in the United States, probably, 85% to 90% of the people are going to be watching Arsenal against Manchester City. And then the remaining 10%, roughly, probably then spread between U.S. Open Cup, CONCACAF Champions League, and then other Premier League matches and other matches. So everyone's going to be watching that Arsenal-Man City game. But this does give an opportunity for U.S. Open Cup and U.S. soccer and lower league soccer. David and Goliath. I mean, there are some big matchups here. As we've seen last year, too, it's very possible that a lower league team that's plays good football, well-organized, good supporters, fan base, can go all the way to the final and give a MLS team a run for its money. It's definitely exciting.
People aren't going to be watching Derby d'Italia on at the same time as Arsenal Man City.
Well, that's the thing, though, too, right? Probably not. I mean, that's the thing, though, too, because I can guarantee you, right, that almost all the attention is going to be on one game. And that's how it is almost every weekend, right? For when there's a big match on, mainstream America is watching. I mean, you look at the actual TV viewership numbers. So not to say that the Derby Italia is not going to be a bigger or more important or better game, but the reality is the majority of people are going to be watching Arsenal against Man City, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's not, actually. And obviously, that's a massive game in the Premier League. There are other big games in the Premier League. You know, I'm really kind of curious. I'm not sure if it's tomorrow or Wednesday. Again, I mean, it's not that I didn't know Manchester City was playing Arsenal. I just didn't know if it was Tuesday or Wednesday. And when the guy started talking about Wednesday's game, I assumed he meant the local U.S. Open Cup match. But Brentford-Chelsea, I think, is really interesting because that's a derby where if Brentford wins, they will probably finish above Chelsea in the league table, which I think is just something that is inconceivable if you think about the context of West London. So that's actually probably the Premier League match I'm most interested in, as crazy as it sounds, because it's just it really is inconceivable. And it's one of those things where I still don't believe it's true. So I just assume Chelsea will win this match, and then we'll be talking 10 years from now. Oh, remember that period in the season when Brentford were ahead of Chelsea in the table? But the final table won't reflect that. But maybe it will. Maybe Brentford will win.
And then going back to the Golasso Network for a minute too, because hats off to them, because we did criticize them for not really kind of paying attention to lower league soccer. They're doing that. And if you look at all the different types of soccer that they cover, so obviously European soccer, Serie A, and the women's soccer, NWSL, you have this game for US Open Cup, or these games for US Open Cup. And you look at Morning Footy, and Morning Footy definitely is one of my criticisms before the show started was that it seemed to be very MLS-centric as far as the whole crew, and with some of the things that had been said about how they want to give Americans a perspective based on Americans playing abroad and kind of a very American-centric approach. And actually, in reality, it's been very eclectic. It's been very varied. They've covered a lot of different topics throughout each day and have quite a variety. Now, whether that's enough to keep people's attention and to get them watching on a daily basis or however often they watch, that is the big challenge. But so far, they're doing much better than I thought they would. And but it's almost day to day. Like some days are great, some days are really nothing much to talk about. But it is difficult. It's probably one of the most difficult jobs in soccer on television, how to keep everyone happy.
Yeah, I do think that at some point topics become stale, right? And that's something, particularly in the format they're in, that they're going to discover. I mean, I've discovered this with ESPN FC. Keeping things fresh every day sometimes is tough. Now, once the transfer window opens, it becomes very simple, although maybe with their American focus, it's a little less transfer-centric. I did find their conversation on Monday morning about U.S. soccer's hiring a little strange, because I think that there's this reflexive I don't even know how to put it. This reflexive bias against anything that's British among some pundits in the U.S. So I maybe get overly sensitive when I hear criticisms of the hiring of Crocker, who, by the way, you know, he has a great resume, but I would say that Dan Ashworth, who then did the same thing at Brighton and now is doing the same thing at Newcastle, was probably the driving force behind the success of the FA at the U17 and U20 levels at the time. And Crocker was there and didn't do a terrible job at Southampton, but I don't think he's Dan Ashworth. So it's not like you're getting the gold-plated product. But still, I found some of the discussion on Morning Footy to be like, well, there's this British guy. Why are we bringing in a British guy, right? I don't know if you got that sense from the conversation. But that kind of disappointed me, because I think that's a reflexive reaction in American soccer whenever someone who's European or British is hired.
Yeah, I missed that particular episode on Monday, but it is something. You know, I mean, if it was a Dutch person coming in, or if it was a German coach, I don't think the questioning or the kind of curiosity or kind of criticism would be as heavy, but oftentimes, I think when it is someone that's English, that criticism comes through harder, and there's a lot of kind of like, well, why are we bringing this guy in instead of this other guy who's American, who knows us, who knows the team?
I was going to say it's used against Americans, too, because there's this saying that they have, we need someone who, quote, understands the American player, unquote. And that I've noticed, I used to think that was, okay, that's a bias against Europeans. They don't want, or South Americans, they don't want anyone from outside. Then I realized it was also used against American coaches that may test the norms of American players. Like 10 years ago, that guy was Caleb Porter, right? Caleb Porter was a guy that was very different coming out of Akron when he managed Akron than most American coaches. And he would kind of push the boundaries of what American players were traditionally comfortable with. Same thing with Eric Rinaldo, who we mentioned earlier at Cal FC, etc. So now I've realized some of that is just a crux to kind of protect the habits of American players and the kind of status quo mediocrity of the program and of American men's soccer.
Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, this person, Crocker, is going to have a lot of influence within U.S. soccer as the new sporting director, is going to be hiring the general manager, who is going to be hiring the coach. Thoughts in terms of what you mentioned, in terms of what Morning Footy were kind of hinting at, is that, okay, if it's an English sporting director, maybe he'll hire an English general manager, and then maybe they'll hire a English manager or someone with English ties. Jesse Marsh would be an example of somebody that has a lot of English ties in terms of having worked there and knows Crocker, etc. Do you think this puts Jesse Marsh in that pole position, Carter, given the relationship and given those connections, perhaps?
I don't know if he wants the job. Look, he's got a coaching career in Europe. Look, this is, again, something that I have to point out, and Twitter is very unrepresentative, and YouTube is very unrepresentative of reality. Okay, the U.S. men's national team job is not a plum job. It's not on a level. I mean, there were people who were saying, lots of people saying, like, well, if we had gotten to Pep Guardiola, he wouldn't have re-signed with Manchester City, and he would have taken the U.S. job. No, you're not in that frame, nor is any other international job, right? Gareth Southgate, I love the guy. I think he's a renaissance man. I really like him personally. But he's not an elite coach, and he's managing England. Didier Deschamps is not an elite coach, and he's managed France now for a decade, right? International jobs are a rung below top club jobs. My understanding of Jesse Marsh, and I do know people connected with him, is that he really wants to test himself at the European level. Now, I don't know, after the breakdown in talks with Southampton and with Leicester, if maybe his mindset's changed in the last 2 months. But even after he got sacked at Leeds, he still wanted to find that next big European job that he could manage and was not really focused on the national team. Now, maybe that changes also with a guy like Crocker, because maybe Marsh is like, okay, I'll be comfortable if I'm reporting to Crocker, who understands kind of the global game better in my mind than if I'm reporting to some former U.S. men's national team player who doesn't have the same experience I do now going and managing in Austria and managing in Germany and managing in England. So maybe he's back in the frame, but my guess is no. I don't think he wants the job. And by the way, he would be my first choice for the job if he wanted the job. And he was my first choice 4 years ago, and I have a paper trail of tweets about that. So I've been on the Jesse Marsh bandwagon for the USMNT for a while, but I think maybe his station in coaching is well above where the U.S. men's national team is now after going to Europe and doing a fairly good job at a couple clubs.
The other thing about Crocker, though, too, is that by bringing someone from the outside and bringing them into U.S. soccer, sometimes people get upset because, it's a very incestuous relationship where people within U.S. soccer like to hire people from within the system, people that they know. Oftentimes it's friends. Oftentimes it's players that they used to work with. So someone like, say, Carlos Bocanegra, who I think passed on the opportunity, or Oguchi Onuehu. I mean, definitely both Carlos and Oguchi, players with good professional careers and have also had post-playing careers too at different levels, would be probably people that would be considered, and I think both of them were in the running or passed on it, or they didn't make it anyway. But oftentimes too, I think that's sometimes the thinking is, like, why are we hiring someone outside of this bubble? And it's uneasy for some people because it's something they don't know. But Crocker, this could be a really great signing for US soccer. This could be somebody that has the experience, that knows how to run an organization, make the right decisions, and having come from Southampton and the FA, could be on the right path, Kartik.
Yeah, I'd actually argue Bocanegra among Americans is kind of out of that bubble, like I mentioned Caleb Porter 10 years ago. He's a guy that, first of all, has a different agent. And I know most people don't know the inside baseball of this, but agents make a big difference. And Bocanegra has a different agent than most of the people in U.S. soccer. Secondly, at Atlanta, he built a team with Darren Eales, who's now at Newcastle, by the way, and is British. That was very kind of eclectic and foreign and did a lot of things differently than the typical American running an MLS club. So I actually think he would be that different. My understanding is he said no. He didn't want the job. So that's yeah, but I think Crocker could be a huge hire if they let him, if he has the autonomy and freedom that we hope he does. Now, we've thought in the past there have been these false starts where we think U.S. soccer is changing, and they brought in someone really impressive, and look, they brought someone in from outside, and maybe that someone from outside will shake things up, and then there's always internal pressures. That's what Jurgen Klinsmann faced. That's what Bob Bradley faced. That's what other people have faced. I think that's very much what Ernie Stewart faced. There is still pressure in the building. There is still pressure from the same powers that be. There is still pressure from the same agency of connected people that are in U.S. soccer. So it on paper appears to be a really good hire and a positive change. But we've had this head fake, I want to say, three or four times in the past from U.S. soccer, and it's never quite worked out.
What's your take on Jesse Marsh? I mean, if he had stayed in the job at Leeds, do you think Leeds would be in a better position now than what they are under Javi Gracia?
That's a great question, because I think they would have scored more goals. I think they would have created more chances. But I think that the chaotic type of football that Jesse Marsh favors, the Red Bull style, very much an Iraniac disciple, I think that, quite frankly, would have been difficult in terms of keeping clean sheets, and maybe they wouldn't have lost 6-1 or 5-0, but they still may have lost games 4-3, 3-2. So I think what Leeds needed, if they were going to part ways with Marsh, was to bring in Sean Dyche. And they didn't do that. So I'm trying to remember the timing. Maybe Dyche had already been hired by Everton, but they needed to bring in that type of manager. Otherwise, maybe they were better off sticking with Marsh. So I think they may be in the same position or slightly higher. I understand why Marsh was sacked. I was very unhappy about it when it happened, just from my own personal emotion and standpoint, but I understand why he was sacked. I also don't understand why then you bring in a manager. This happened, by the way, at Watford. I mean, there were games when Gracia was at Watford where they gave up 4 or 5 goals. He did a pretty good job there, but still, he's not a defensive manager. So I don't know why, if they were trying to survive, they didn't bring in a guy that was going to tighten them at the back. Now, the flip side is true, though. Maybe you can play your way out. Gary O'Neill, Bournemouth's not safe yet, and they just shipped 4 goals on Sunday. But Bournemouth seemed to have played their way out of the bottom three, right? By scoring a lot of goals and being open, but beating teams 3-2, etc. So maybe it would have worked with Marsh. Maybe they would have gotten the 35 points. I certainly wouldn't be worse. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and then one more thing from this past weekend. Arguably, the biggest game on Saturday was not the Man City against Sheffield United FA Cup semi final, but it was Wrexham. I mean, if you went on social media, it just completely blew up. Wrexham did it finally. They got promoted to League Two. They defeated Boreham Wood 3-1 on the day, even though Boreham Wood scored in the first 15 seconds of the match. And honestly, Kartik, I don't see anything stopping this juggernaut from getting bigger. I mean, they're coming on tour to the US this summer. They're playing Chelsea and the Manchester United Academy, and are expected to announce 2 more friendlies. Then season 2 of Welcome to Wrexham is going to be out in the late summer. And before you know it, League 2, the new season will be in August. It'll be here before you know it. And I think in many ways what Wrexham has done, yes, they've benefited from Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, But I think what they've done on the pitch as well as off the pitch, and I mean, which includes in the communities, in terms of everything that they've done for Wrexham, I think in many ways they've done actually a better job of marketing the club than many Premier League teams in the US. So I think there's a lot of learning lessons there in terms of what they've done. I'm curious, though, Carter, because I know you're an expert in the US, probably the top expert on the English Football League, even from the Championship all the way down to League Two. How you think Wrexham will fare in League Two this upcoming season?
Well, first off, I don't think they're going to be able to keep Paul Mullen. I think he is going to be in the Championship next year, or maybe a League One team pushing promotion. You have a situation at the top of League One right now where you have two automatic promotion spots and three really established clubs that are on top of one another. One of them may not go up. So maybe Paul Mullen ends up there. Maybe he ends up at Sheffield Wednesday next year. I think they're going to be pieces picked apart. Phil Parkinson, I assume, will stay, but he's also a League One championship level manager historically. That Wrexham has spent a lot of money to get this group of players and this coach up. Now maybe that they've accomplished promotion, does the team get raided? Obviously, they have the money to keep guys. Let me also suggest, actually, this is a little bit of a diversion, but Ben Foster has a great YouTube channel that I've been watching all season long, from August onward. The cycling goalkeeper, right? Because he's a cycler, in addition to being a great former England international, a great two-decade-long keeper in English football. You get some of the best scenes of what happened at Wrexham from watching his YouTube channel, and the fact that they were able to tempt him out of retirement. He had other offers, because like I said, I've been watching his YouTube channel since he launched it. I'm a fan of his, actually, as a player too. So he had other offers that he would talk about during the season and be like, yeah, you know, there was a Premier League team that approached me that needs some cover as a keeper, or Championship team, and I'm retired, I'm enjoying doing this show. And then Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney called him. And what was the answer? Yes, I'll go. Now, he has a tie to Wrexham. At one time, he was loaned there early in his career. But that kind of tells me, Ben Foster kind of tells me the draw of Wrexham. So maybe they don't lose Paul Mullen. Maybe Phil Parkinson sticks it out for another year in League Two. They have a squad right now that can compete in League Two. I just am not sure they keep the squad together, is my point, I guess, in a roundabout way is what I'm trying to say. And I think Mullen would be the first guy I look at, because I think they're Championship clubs, even at toward the bottom of the Championship. Let's say Huddersfield stays up. Let's say QPR stays up. I think they're going to want to take a flyer on Paul Mullen, because he's a pure English number nine that can do some other things off the ball. I mean, we've seen how dynamic he is. We've seen how influential he is, and what a winner he is in reality.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, though, too. Like, anyone who's watched Wrexham play and seen Paul Mullen has seen, I mean, that's just, I mean, Ollie Palmer and other players, too. But Paul Mullen certainly stands out. And I could see him dominating in the Championship, even for a team like Blackburn or Middlesbrough, whoever it may be. And it really comes down to that player. It comes down to him, because does he want to play at a Championship club, kind of a higher level? However, arguably, right, in League Two, he'd get more publicity, he'd get more press coverage, he'd get more attention, he'd get more one-on-one love as someone from just that Wrexham effect than he would even in the Championship. So it really comes down to him in terms of what he wants in his professional career. I mean, the money would be better in the Championship. I mean, they'd be offering more money, more acclaim, more opportunities. Yeah, that's going to be a really tough one. Ben Foster's a great example, though, too, Kartik. I mean, what a great hire that was. And that one decision to hire him, bring him in towards the end of the season, could have made the difference in actually keeping them up, especially if they had not won that game against Notts County in that last minute.
Yeah, he made the Notts County game specifically with that penalty save. I was going to ask you. I mean, you're a supporter of the hottest team in the Football League right now, in Swansea. They have 19 points out of their last 21, if I recall correctly. I just wrote an article about them the other day, so I'm thinking that was the stat I cited. And things are really working well. The one thing Swansea doesn't have is target kind of dynamic number nine like Paul Mullen. What if he moved from North Wales to South Wales? You guys might be in playoff contention next year for promotion back to the Premier League. So I think that I'm just using Swansea as an example because of you, but I think there were a lot of clubs in the Championship who were thinking, because we've seen it. We've seen Jamie Vardy. We've seen others move from non-league to League One or the Championship and then end up in the Premier League. It's not as unprecedented as one might think, which goes back to my kind of frustration about the lack of emphasis on lower divisions in the U.S., because it can happen here too, where it's not just clubs we're talking about, it's players who don't get looks, who maybe don't get the chance. But Paul Mullen, I think, is going to be a hot commodity, and that might be priority number one for Wrexham. Lock him down. Make sure you keep him for next year.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, especially in this day and age where there's not a lot of number nines, even kind of a classic number nine. And Paul Mullen reminds me of a little bit of Jamie Vardy, for sure. A little bit of Harry Kane, just even the goal he scored against Boreham Wood. I mean, so he has that unique skill, which I'm confident that in terms of his ability, that he would be able to shine even in the Championship. I mean, it's a big step up, but I think the gap between the Championship and League Two isn't that great. I mean, it's personally, I think in terms of League Two, I think they've got a good chance of going up, especially with Phil Parkinson as a manager. But partly because, I mean, there's three teams that go up, right? So there's a greater opportunity. So they might go up through the playoffs. I mean, there's more opportunities, and it's harder to get out of the National League. National League, they've done it now. They don't have to worry about that. There's very little fear of going back down there for quite a while. So I think they could go. I mean, if they get up to League One, who knows from there? I mean, they're going to be playing against some big teams. But yeah, you're right, Kartik. That's probably the biggest question out of all of this is, are they able to actually hold on to the players that they've got and then build the squad, make some changes? That's the key.
Two more really quick points on this. One, Stockport County, who I do follow and got promoted from the National League last year, they held off Wrexham, obviously big match in Welcome to Wrexham that everyone saw later. They're 1 point away from automatic promotion right now. Maybe needs Stevenage has a match in hand, so maybe we need them to drop that match in hand to have a real shot. But if you get promoted from the National League, you're generally fighting for promotion the next year from League Two. You're not fighting relegation. It's very different than the other divisions of English football that way. Second point, Chris, at the beginning of the show, you talked about the conversation about lower division soccer has changed since we recorded that podcast a few weeks ago. I will say that this is a big part of it, because the conversation about Wrexham and Wrexham being in people's faces in the United States has forced a conversation about lower division soccer, promotion and relegation, pro league standards, all of this sort of stuff in the United States. So Wrexham is doing their part inadvertently, although maybe it's blatant, because now Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds are talking about promotion and relegation, right? It's this wonderful thing. Is doing its part to elevate lower divisions in the United States in terms of recognition and conversation. So the Wrexham story has many implications. And this might, we were, 6 months ago, we did a podcast about why are MLS fans so insecure about Wrexham? Maybe we're seeing why now, because as I said, they're elevating the conversation here in the States about lower division teams in the United States, not specifically about England itself. And that's England or Wales itself. That's really important.
Yeah, and that might have been about 9 months ago. It's we were talking about that pretty, I think maybe September or so, when it was Welcome to Wrexham had premiered, and you and I were talking about how come no one's talking about this? How come no one's really, the fans are talking about it, but how come media's not talking about it? How come, journalists are not talking about it? How come, television's not talking about it? But that soon changed. I mean, this has been just incredible to see. But you're right, Kartik, because that is the thing. There's so many questions being asked now, is why don't we have something like this? Why is all this attention on Wrexham? And even if, obviously, Ryan and Rob help a great deal in terms of the name recognition and having people kind of focus on this team and learn about it. But arguably, if you didn't have Rob and Ryan, and if there's still a Welcome to Wrexham documentary that didn't include those two, it may not have the same effect in terms of reach, but it is a heartwarming tale. It is very focused on the community, and it tells the story, a true story of what's happening to that club and what their hopes and aspirations are. And we're seeing this in real time, in real life, in terms of match by match. So to watch season two is going to be really interesting, because I think season one, most people didn't really know what was going to happen, except for soccer diehards like ourselves and many of the listeners. But outside of that, most people probably didn't know what was going to happen in season one, other than that they didn't get promoted at the end. Season two, I think everyone knows what happened. So it's going to be really interesting to watch season two, because is it going to feel like kind of just a like a highlights reel, like for the whole season, like, oh, this is what happened, and they met Prince Charles, King Charles, and they won this game in the last minute after that penalty save. Is it going to feel like a highlight reel, or are there going to be topics that they dive into that kind of expand the Wrexham story, or get us thinking about other things, or showing us behind the scenes footage that we had no idea what was happening? And then that feeds into next season, right, in League Two. So this whole concept, whether by accident or design, is tremendous. And this has done so much more than the All or Nothing series, right? I mean, there's been some good ones and some really bad ones. No one's talking about All or Nothing.
Yeah, hey, believe we're making the comparison, honestly.
Right.
I mean, that stuff was garbage by comparison.
Yeah, but there's been many other documentaries. I mean, Sunderland Till I Die, right? Sunderland are coming to the United States this summer. And Sunderland Till I Die was many, many years ago now. But it didn't have quite the same impact. I mean, it had the reverse story. It had showing a club going down the divisions and the turmoil and what it meant to fans to kind of suffer from relegation, experience relegation. We're now seeing the opposite of Sunderland Till I Die. So, yeah, hats off to Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. I think in many ways for actually making the right decision to because they could have gone to seven or eight clubs they looked at and basically analyzed to figure out, okay, which club are we going to buy? And I think they made the right decision for many, many different reasons. And the Ben Foster thing where, yes, he played for them on loan as a young, 19-year-old goalkeeper kind of just starting out, and then to see his career come back to Wrexham, they could do a whole episode.
The cycling goalkeeper, if you don't know about the YouTube channel, check it out. I highly recommend it. Again, I'm a Ben Foster fan, so I subscribed at the beginning of the year when he, quote, retired from Watford. He goes into detail, because during the course of the season, he said, like, I had this offer. He didn't mention the club, but from a Premier League club, from a Championship club, I'm happy doing this. I'm happy spending time with y'all. And then the Wrexham offer came in, and he explained why he took it, which was, again, the ambition of the club. Yes, the tie that he had been there on loan, that factored in. But also, he said, I would be lying if I didn't say, look, I'm now kind of in the media landscape, and these two guys are pop celebrities, and they have the ability to kind of elevate what I'm doing also. So I think that's really important to if you want to see the impact of Reynolds and McElhenney even on the thoughts of players and of famous players, because Ben Foster is a famous player, usually by non-league standards, right? So it's the whole package, right? And it's a juggernaut, really, and it's rolling down the hill, and it feels like it's unstoppable.
Well, just wait till the summer, right? Because, Wrexham's playing Chelsea in Chapel Hill, and that stadium has a capacity of 50,000. And then they're playing Manchester United's academy at Snapdragon in San Diego, and that capacity is 35,000. And then they're supposed to play a couple of friendlies against Major League Soccer teams. I wouldn't be surprised if they play Philadelphia Union in Philly, Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and other games too. So just imagine in terms of just the fan base, fans in the United States being able to go to games, but also the television coverage, interviews, and what they have planned for the U.S. tour, and how that is going to be different than perhaps some of the Premier League teams or La Liga teams or teams from Liga MX that are doing their own tours this summer. This is going to be really, really fascinating to watch. And like you said, Kartik, I think it's going to blow up big time in a really great way.
I have to say, I think there's more interest in Wrexham than there is in most Premier League teams in the U.S. right now. Maybe that seems like an exaggeration. Maybe I'm in a bit of a bubble. Again, a lower league bubble. So lower league U.S. fans are really into Wrexham. They're not that into the Premier League. But it just feels that way to me.
Yeah, I think Arsenal's the exception. I think Arsenal is definitely, I mean, despite recent results, I mean, there's a buzz about Arsenal. And I think a lot of it, too, is also kind of Arsenal fans that have been here for generations, that have suffered through some tough times, just have, as Manchester United fans maybe suffered in the late 70s and early 80s before they came good. But yeah, I look at the top 10 stories from the past few months, even on our website. We've got, you know, hundreds of stories about Arsenal, hundreds of stories about Napoli, hundreds of stories about you name it. Out of that top 10, many of those most popular stories are Wrexham stories. And so it's going to an audience, it is in the mainstream of America. And there are a lot more people probably talking about Wrexham than they are talking about maybe, I don't know, Leicester City, even though Leicester City, this Leicester City on its own is a good story, but Wrexham, I'm sure, has more interest right now than Leicester City, as just one example. All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. First up to talk about CBS Sports' UEFA coverage is Brendan. Brendan says, I never watch it. I watch BT Sport from the UK. It is excellent. Rio Ferdinand, Joe Cole, Michael Owen, Owen Hargreaves, Peter Crouch, brilliant analysts. My take on this, Kartik, is I don't rate Michael Owen at all. I think a lot of, I don't know, stereotypes or just really poor analysis. Rio Ferdinand, I don't think is that good either. Joe Cole, you know better than I do, so I'm not sure about Joe Cole. Owen Hargreaves is really good. And then Peter Crouch is almost a stand-up comedian kind of side of the analysis. What about you? What about Joe Cole as a analyst? Have you had much experience kind of listening in to him?
Yeah, and I've actually watched some interviews he's done. He's got potential. He's not nearly at a Carragher Neville level yet, but of that group, of that BT Sport group, I think he's probably the one with the most potential of the former players. Hargreaves, to me, very kind of drying and boring. He makes some decent points, and obviously he has experience having played in Germany as well, so he can talk about Bayern, who are really kind of really FC Hollywood again now with what's going on at that club. But I don't really like the BT coverage either, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here. Jonathan says, you guys are really going to die on the hill that CBS's coverage of the Champions League isn't the best coverage in the US right now? They may joke a lot, but Thierry Henry laughing gives more tactical insight than 5 minutes with Tim Howard on NBC. I disagree with this. Tim Howard, maybe from 2 years ago, I would say yes. But Tim Howard from now is a lot more insightful, is really kind of getting more into the player psyche and sharing some of those things and some of the analysis that is far better than what he was doing before. Thierry Henry is good, definitely, but sometimes there's definitely a little bit of a language barrier. Sometimes he's kind of like, it's hard to pick up what he's saying. And when he slows it down a bit, you can kind of understand it a little bit more. For the most part, I understand everything he says. But now and again, it just doesn't come out right. Or doesn't, you just have to kind of, in between Jamie and his Scouse accent and then Micah kind of laughing, and it gets a little bit chaotic at times to be able to hear their tactical insight. But Kartik, what's your thoughts on who has the best coverage of soccer in the US right now? What do you think?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I mean, I think overall it's probably CBS because they tailor make their product in each area to the audience, right? We've talked about this. They cover each league or competition they cover differently, unlike ESPN, who has a kind of a one-size-fits-all formula, and NBC that only covers one thing. But I think in terms of that Champions League studio, Kate Abdo is very good. I do agree on Thierry Henry. I think he's very good, although I disagree that Tim Howard doesn't give tactical analysis. I think he probably gives more tactical analysis than anyone at NBC other than Danny Higginbottom. I think the rest of the team is kind of laughy-laughy, jokey-jokey. To be honest with you, I don't get as much out of Carragher on CBS as I do on Sky. On Sky, he's pushed by Neville. Gary Neville is really good. Carragher, if in his comfort zone, there's not much real analysis there. He gets pushed by Neville. Neville challenges him a lot on set. If you ever watch some of Sky studio coverage, it's not just the host that pushes Carragher, it's Neville. And that brings the best out of him, but he doesn't get pushed like that on CBS.
Yeah, and the question, it depends how you kind of perceive the question about who has the best soccer coverage in the US right now. You said CBS more so for kind of how it's covering a lot of the different leagues and competitions and US soccer. But for me, if I take it from kind of just in terms of analysis, presentation of whatever soccer league or competition or various ones that they're doing, I still think NBC Sports is still at the top in terms of what they're providing with Rebecca and Danny Higginbotham and Stephen Warnock at times and Tim Howard and the two Robbies, even though it is only one league. But in terms of what they're doing still, I think it's still the gold standard. Next up is Dave. Dave says, I enjoy that CBS and NBC take different approaches to covering soccer, just as it is fun that TUDN and Telemundo differ. I think we are lucky that so many broadcasters are putting a big push for soccer. Not everything is a home run, but they all hit much more than they miss. Yeah, and that I agree with 100%. Chris says, when it comes to the studio coverage from CBS of the Champions League, I find it to be too jokey at times. However, having said that, if CBS decided to cover the Champions League in the same way they cover the NFL or the PGA Tour, they would be labeled as too serious and might be accused of talking down to the average American soccer fan. This is something that many college football fans find issue with when it comes to CBS's coverage of that sport, and I can see why CBS is trying to avoid that with the Champions League. I have a question, Chris says, about Warner Brothers Discovery's upcoming coverage of the US Open Cup. My question to you, Kartik, is do you see TNT or TBS airing some of the matches, including the US Open Cup final?
Yeah, I think maybe the final will be on TNT or TBS. And if they get some sort of Cinderella story, although... I don't know. Maybe they're not as invested in what goes on in the domestic professional game, to know when those Cinderella stories are there. Because, again, I point to Fox 10 years ago, or I guess now it would have been 2012, right? So 11 years ago with Eric Winalda and Cal FC. Now, obviously, Winalda and Nick Webster both worked for Fox, but there was also the recognition that, okay, this is something that lower division fans in the U.S. are kind of interested in, an amateur team coached by a very famous figure in American soccer, and Eric Winalda, making a run. Let's pick this game up and show it nationally. I don't know if Turner quite has that recognition. Let's say Tormenta wins this match against Charlotte tonight. Again, we're recording this on Tuesday. Let's say they win this match, which is on CBS, as we mentioned. Does Turner have the foresight to pick up Tormenta's next match and realize, okay, this is a Cinderella story. This is a club from Statesboro, Georgia, that is, as I said earlier, I think one of the best built-out lower division professional outfits in the country. And in a place like Statesboro, which is a small college town, right? That's where Georgia Southern is. That's kind of their base, is the fact that it's a college town. Do they have the foresight to pick up that match against an MLS team in the next round? I'm guessing they probably don't. Whereas Fox, for all the criticisms we have of Fox, they understood kind of the domestic game, and they understood that was a big story.
One question I have, Kartik, as a tangent, is do you think CBS Sports Golazo Network would be as interested in the US Open Cup as they are now if the Wrexham story didn't happen?
No, I think the Wrexham story, like I said a little earlier, is driving a lot. Again, I'm kind of in a lower division USL NISA bubble to a certain extent. That's why I made the comment, and maybe it sounds outrageous to a lot of fans, that I think Wrexham is bigger than the Premier League clubs right now. But I do think it's driving so much of the conversation in this country, especially at the lower division level. And as I said, CBS, local CBS stations have established relationships with local USL clubs to where I think the momentum from Wrexham is fueling a lot of this. And again, I think everyone is picking up on it. So CBS this morning... you know, their morning program, did do a thing on Wrexham getting promoted. Because again, Ryan Reynolds, Rob McElhenney, they're pop celebrities. So I think every media company in the United States, every newsroom in the United States is aware of Wrexham, even if it's a quote Disney property, and it's something that Disney has been pushing. Every other media company is aware of the impact of Wrexham. You know, I'd be really disappointed if NBC, with their coverage of the Premier League and their ties to English football, don't do something to mention Wrexham in the coming weeks, honestly, because it's that big a story.
Yeah, I think for the most part, they've avoided it, really. I mean, I'm sure they've mentioned it on maybe one of the podcasts. I just can't think of anything that they've done that was brought it up. Maybe this weekend, maybe they're listening and they'll do something this weekend. Last question from listener mailbag before we go is Dave continues. He has some thoughts about the World Cup 2026 that we were talking about. And he says, what is the reason to believe that 2026 World Cup will drive sustained increased interest in U.S. domestic leagues? My guess is it might be like the Olympics, where many fans get very engaged for a few weeks and then forget about it for a few years. And Dave and others, I'm not sure how many of you went through the 1994 World Cup or alive during the 1994 World Cup or experienced the 1994 World Cup. But for me personally, being in the United States, it changed everything, right? For me, it was like months prior to the World Cup happening. There was so much coverage, both in the media, newspapers, television, etc. And it just snowballed. And by the time we got to the 1994 World Cup, it was everywhere. Everyone was talking about it. Unfortunately, the O.J. Simpson car chase kind of ruined some of it, took away some of the coverage of that. But it was transformative. And I think the 2026 World Cup, with the popularity of soccer being more entrenched in the United States, is just going to be next level. So, but the question that Dave's asking, will it have sustained increased interest in U.S. domestic leagues? Major League Soccer, I think so. What about the lower leagues, Kartik?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's right for 3 or 4 weeks after it will. My experience is I was around for 94, but my memories are more of 99 and the Women's World Cup. And winning the Women's World Cup, obviously penalty shootout against China at Stanford Stadium, what that did for the game in this country, that was just 5 years later. But because we already had the established professional structure that we didn't have in 94, and granted, that came out of 94, right? MLS and then the A-League, which is now USL or USISL, became stronger as a result of 94. I remember the women's game actually giving a boost to the men's game. And how significant that was. Even you and I were both Miami Fusion fans. How I think there was more media interest in the Fusion for the rest of that 99 season. By the way, speaking of Eric Winalda, he was playing for the team at the time, than you would have had otherwise. My other memories of 2016 Copa America, that definitely helped lower division soccer. I mean, in NASL, we felt a boost based on the Copa being in the country. Now, unfortunately, there were some internal disputes and some of the teams left and went to USL, and I mean, that's the whole soccer wars thing, but it definitely did give a boost to lower division soccer. In terms of MLS, did MLS really benefit from that Copa in 2016? I guess, yeah. I think it kind of did, but it definitely gave a boost to lower division soccer. The thing I do want to point out again, though, which I pointed out on a previous podcast, is the potential gains of that Copa America were squandered because it put a lot of money into the treasury of U.S. soccer, and much of that money was then spent on lawyers' fees because of everything else going on. Yeah, and that very well could happen in 2026 also. I mean, the way U.S. soccer is going, I think it's a strong possibility that they will bank a lot of money and the money will go out the window to pay lawyers because there's some abuse or something going on. The Federation has to clean itself up in the next 3 years to really be able to take advantage of that World Cup.
Yeah, and then those legal fees up to this point are in the tens of millions of dollars. And a lot of those lawsuits are still outstanding, going through the court system. So, you're right, Kartik. There could be many, many more millions to come in terms of legal fees. And hopefully they clean up their act there, too. All right. Lastly, listeners, if you do want to have any you want to share your feedback with us, any questions, thoughts, analysis, observations, or you agree or disagree with us, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. There's a bunch of different ways you can get in touch with us. You can send us an email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can go to the website, worldsoccertalk.com, click on podcasts, and then leave your comment in the latest episode. You can hit us up on Twitter, @worldsoccertalk. There's facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. You can send us a message through there. And then last but not least, if you want to leave a voicemail, it's 561-247-4625. And Kartik, where can people find you and your writings and coverage?
Yeah, check me out on Twitter at KKFLA737 and then beyondthe90.substack.net, which, by the way, this morning is heavy on the CBS Golazo U.S. Open Cup thing. So maybe we covered that so thoroughly on this podcast, you don't want to check out that website for a day or two. But there'll be other content on there. We have a great article on what's ailing Spurs. And then I did an article on Swansea, actually, the other day. But the Tottenham article is really interesting by my colleague Javi Martinez, so you might want to check that out.
All right. Well, we will be back later this week, but in the meantime, there's a lot of soccer from around the world. US Open Cup, there is the Arsenal-Manchester City on Wednesday in the title clash. There is CONCACAF Champions League and much, much more. Kartik, what are you going to be doing this week, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.